Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson, Chair of the Economics Department at the University of San Francisco. This program is sponsored by USF's Master of Science degree in Applied Economics, which teaches the economics frameworks and data science skills needed to understand and contribute to the tech economy, and by USF's Center on Business Studies and Innovation in the Asia Pacific. My guest today is Brian Wong. Like me, Brian was born and raised in Silicon Valley, but we actually met later in life in Shanghai when he joined the small consulting firm I was working for at the time. After I left to join academia, we stayed in touch, and I remember meeting him a few years later and him telling me about how he had joined some kind of Chinese tech startup run by a strangely charismatic former English teacher. Now, my American friends in China always kind of seem to get drawn into these oddball adventures of various sorts, like acting in Chinese movies, starring in game shows, hiking the entire Great Wall, playing in a rock band, things like that. So honestly, I didn't think too much about it at the time. They'd usually come out of it with some great stories and then, you know, get a real job in real life sometime later. But anyway, that startup was Alibaba, which Google tells me as of this morning has a market cap of $165 billion. And Brian was the 52nd employee and the first American on their team. So he's got a little bit more than a story out of it. And this story that Brian was involved in, though, is very much, you know, more than just a cute anecdote to tell his buddies and his grandchildren, but also a very important story in the development of China's economy and the world tech economy. Fortunately for all of us, Brian recognized this and has taken the time over the past couple of years to write a book that doesn't just, tell his story, but also gets into some analytical depth about how Alibaba works as an organization and what lessons it might have for other tech businesses, startups, and also for countries and organizations interested in what they can learn from this piece of China's development success story. Brian, welcome.
Hey, Peter. Thanks so much. That's a great intro, by the way. You recapped a lot of...
Well, really glad to have you.
Yeah. My pleasure. My pleasure.
So that was my little intersections with you. But why don't you give us a more complete picture of your background and the story that led up to you getting involved in Alibaba and deciding to join them?
Okay. Well, it's much of what you just said. Like you, I was born in Palo Alto, and I think you'll recall Palo Alto at that time was not nearly as fancy and sophisticated as it is today. Maybe for the better in some ways.
I'll say I came from Sunnyvale. Oh, okay. I'm going to say I come from Sunnyvale. So we're from down south and you guys up north in Palo Alto were like the fancy people compared to us.
But all right, fine.
Yeah, it's definitely not where it is today.
It's all relative. But, it was still pretty simple life. We lived in Professorville, which meant that a lot of academics around us who were affiliated with Stanford and other schools and a few techies that worked at HP. But I had a pretty uneventful suburban life, playing soccer, little league baseball. And I thought I would be a doctor, in my life. My father was a physician, and that sounds like a very steady career path. But that got all derailed in college when I went to do a language program in Beijing. And like you said, it kind of sparks the curiosity of many who go and travel, and particularly China at that time really kind of opened my eyes to how much potential there was in the world to, help make change in a society that was still very much, transforming from a planned economy into a market one. So after that experience in the summer, I ended up doing grad school in China and thought, hey, you know, rather than healthcare, and the motivation of healthcare was do the greatest good for the greatest number. You know, I thought maybe a career in health policy would be a great and very rewarding experience. But I said, wow, if you can change this society in some way, maybe it doesn't have to be through the healthcare track. And so that's when you and I met, my first job in a consulting firm. And that was an interesting experience because I got to see a lot of kind of the frontier markets in what was emerging in China, particularly around kind of the industrialization where you had a lot of manufacturing taking place and a lot of foreign multinationals trying to figure out their market entry strategies, as you'll remember. But that also got derailed. There was the financial crisis, and this was not the 2008 one. This was 1997. That was the Asian financial crisis, and that actually sent me all the way back to San Francisco with the same firm. But, you know, like every young person in search of answers, I said, well, okay, I've done the consulting thing. What else is there in terms of trying to make change and impact? Oh, let's try the public sector. So I did a short stint in San Francisco government. I was working for the mayor at the time. His name was Willie Brown. And that was a very eye-opening experience from a kind of local politics perspective. It gave me insight into kind of how the public sector really intersects with society and what its role is. But I was fortunate enough at that time that I also had the chance to meet Jack Ma, who in 1999 was coming to Silicon Valley to do some fundraising with his CFO, Joe, who was someone that I knew from before. And Joe was kind enough to introduce me to Jack on that trip. As many people know, you know, Jack met with like 30 VCs and didn't raise a single dollar. But I was very fortunate enough to meet him. And what really struck me in our conversation, I remember we met at the St. Francis Hotel and we were just having tea with him and Joe, and Jack had this charisma about what he really wanted to do with Alibaba, and to change, you know, China and the society through e-commerce, and that e-commerce was really focused on helping small businesses, you know, connect with the world. And I said, well, if you could do that, that is very substantive. That's also using technology as a way to impact, you know, society in a positive way. Let me give it a shot. And so that started my career at Alibaba, as you mentioned. I thought it would be 2 years and then do something else to kind of experience work in a tech company in China. But it turned out to be, you know, almost two decades. So the book that you mentioned, The Tao of Alibaba, which I just completed and will be published, is really an attempt to explain the path that Alibaba took in light of the external events that were happening at that time, but also from the inside to reveal kind of the way of thinking that led the decisions, you know, of the team and the management, but also an ethos that I think is useful for anyone today that's trying to do a startup.
That's great. Yeah, that's a good intro to like how you came to it, you know, what background you brought. So actually one sort of interim thing I think is interesting is that you did take a break from Alibaba and went to Wharton, to, you know, one of the America's premier business schools, to get your MBA, and then ultimately came back. So you know, you got that kind of, you know, classic U.S. business school education. How did that relate to your experiences before and after at Alibaba? Like, what do you see as things that were there lessons that were confirmed? Like your professors told you that and you nodded and like, yeah, that's how it works. Or were there, and what things worked out kind of differently from what they recommended?
Sure. No, like I left Alibaba after 2 years to go to Wharton, mainly because I felt like those 2 years at that time, I mean, keep in mind, we started in the apartment just at the very kind of tail end when we were still in Hangzhou and then moved to an office. But things were still very chaotic within the company and we were trying all sorts of things that didn't seem to work. And I wondered, you know, why are we spending our time just running in circles? And I said, maybe if I go to business school and really learn how business should be done properly. Because keep in mind, in college, I was a English lit major in pre-med, so that wasn't very relevant to doing business. I thought I had a lot more that I needed to learn on that front. So I went to Wharton, and it was obviously a very rigorous education around business principles, business management, financial analysis and those things. And I think those tools obviously are useful in business. But one thing I realized is you have to also put it in the context of the market that you're in and sort of calibrate when you use those tools. China and the internet in China at that time was very, very much a rudimentary industry, and there was no infrastructure like retail sector. Even the financial sector was still very rudimentary. A lot of that stuff had to be built from scratch. And so what's the precedence that you have to lean on in those cases? So I would say that in some ways I had to unlearn some of my business school stuff when I went back to Alibaba. So after Wharton, I spent 2 years in New York working at a large multinational firm, and then got invited back to Alibaba to lead some of their international operations. And even at that point, the company was still very much in its sort of development phase, although it had grown, obviously. But I had to sort of modify my mindset to a market that was still very raw and underdeveloped. And so I think there are certain principles that came in more use than others that I, learned at Wharton, but were not emphasized, because I think a lot of people, when you're in business school, you're thinking about, going to Wall Street and using these financial skills for modeling, or, these frameworks and consulting. But if contextually they don't quite apply to a market that doesn't have any of those things, then what do you lean on? And that's where I realized there was something kind of bigger to all this, which is, these fluffy concepts that we learned in Wharton but didn't pay attention to until probably most of us, decades afterwards. Things like mission, vision, and values. How does that guide a company in its early stage in terms of its formation, but also how does it define the character of the company and the kind of people you attract? And then as you're moving through the development stage, how does that kind of keep the company on track when you're making decisions that there are no precedents for? So I would say that that was one critical factor that I realized is more important than I recognized, is the importance of a mission, vision, and value in the organization. Second, I would say is this Jack talked about this. Towards the end of his time when he was at Alibaba, this concept of leadership having IQ, EQ, and something called LQ. LQ being love quotient. And a lot of people laughed. They said, oh, that's unusual. What do you mean by that? And really what that refers to is kind of having empathy and a big heart in the things that you're doing, so that you kind of take the bigger picture in mind when you're building a business. It's not just about purely profits that your company is trying to generate. It's not just about coming up with, the most sophisticated technology. It's how does it apply to society? And I think that got me to my third kind of takeaway from all this, is that you can build a business that does good for business and good for society. And Alibaba, in my mind, part of the reason why I wrote this book is I wanted to show the world why, or a case of an example where you had a wildly successful business built on, all the technology and these principles that we generally will look at, but that it can also have a positive impact on addressing many of society's problems. And this being in China, some fundamental problems that they were trying to overcome as an emerging market, this company provided the solutions to many of those problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great perspective. So I think let's address those in turn. So we'll get back to second this question of, how Alibaba sort of contributed to China's development model and and maybe what lessons could be learned by other companies or countries for that. I think that's really important. You know, I think if we're going to say, you know, what brought the most people out of poverty in the, you know, the past 50 years, it's really China's success story in economic development. And there's lots of people who would like to take credit for that or, you know, not give credit for that. But certainly Alibaba in the past 20 years has been an important part of that. But first let's talk about, how does this company work? So we've got, you told us about love quotient. So all you need is love. So if we put John Lennon in charge of your company, I could see that. So part of the thing that they, you know, just me opining is that, you know, as an outsider, like definitely the Jack Ma's charisma and enthusiasm been a huge part of that. And his kind of, you know, goofiness, as well is all kind of a package. But you know, how does that translate into an actual company, working?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what it does is it provides people kind of a North Star in terms of why they're even at the company and then what they're trying to achieve. You know, when thinking about maybe in the first iteration, you know, what we're trying to do with the business to business platform, it's recognizing that small businesses are kind of the heart and soul of the private sector economy, and that this is a growing sector that needs help, but they couldn't compete with the either the state owned enterprises or the large corporations because they didn't have the means nor the capabilities. And so in a lot of ways that LQ sort of aspect is a motivating factor in terms of saying, you know, we're here to help the little guy. We're here to kind of do what we can to provide a level playing field, and we'll do whatever it takes to achieve that. And I think that's a motivating factor, but also it helps guide decisions when thinking about strategy. And when you go down to execution, you know, when you run into problems, you will say, okay, well, what's in the best interest of these people we're trying to serve? And, you know, I know that we talk about these things often in kind of business talk, you know, customer centric or whatnot. But when you put it kind of more with an emotional sort of element to it, and it's sincere in terms of what the company stands for. And what I do believe is that, you know, when I do this entrepreneur training courses, I always ask the students, I say, okay, so let's start off with why don't you guys tell me what your company mission is? You know, most of the class, they'll stop and then they'll pick up their phone and then start scrolling for some information, probably their homepage or their corporate profile, and they have to look it up. And that just says to me that this hasn't been internalized, right? The purpose of the organization has not been really internalized in a way that it's at the tip of their tongue and they know exactly why they're doing what they're doing.
Right. So, they just paid a consultant or a marketing person to write something up that sounded good, but they don't actually think about it on a daily basis.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one aspect of this, you know, this LQ, but I also think that just internally caring for your team members in a way that you're also trying to develop them. And one thing that we talked about in terms of leadership principles is that, you know, your job as a leader is to ensure that your team members, the individuals, become the best that they can be in terms of what they're trying to achieve. And, you know, contrary to a lot of the, the conversations around 996 and whatnot, I mean, it sounds like a sweat factory, you know, in a lot of these tech companies. And, you know, they're at Alibaba, there's very much a conscientious focus on trying to help develop and enable the individuals at the firm so that whatever they're doing, whether they're working 996 or some other hours, like it's geared towards something that is important to them as individuals. And I think that's also where this kind of LQ comes into play.
So part of the, you know, that's easier to do and good when, you know, you're a growing firm with high demand, has, but, you know, then sometimes you have to lay people off. Has Alibaba ever faced that where, you know, you love people, you're trying to develop them, and then it's like, oh, shoot, we got to cut costs. We can't do everything that's just because it's cool. It makes us feel good because, yeah, you know, we got to at least, you know, balance the books.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, in particularly, I think recently there's been difficulty, you know, in that regard. I think the first thing, what they normally would do is try and find a role for the individual rather than fire them immediately. Try and find a role that they can play that you can utilize their skills in other departments or other divisions or other functions before you have to you know, eliminate them. And that's the general practice. So it's a bit more sort of compassionate, I guess, in a way. You kind of give them an opportunity. But, you know, when it comes to, you know, financial downturns and things that you have to kind of be very decisive on, I think that also is, well, you look at it this way. I mean, what's in the best interest of the individual and the company, you have to kind of mediate that by facing the reality, but also give them a soft exit if that's the case.
So one crucial thing about Alibaba is that it's a tech firm, but not led by a tech guy. I mean, a lot, you know, obviously anyone by the time they're CEO, they're not like writing code and, you know, solving bugs or anything, but most of the, but not all, you know, many of the leaders like of the tech firm started sort of in the nitty gritty of like, of this foundational stuff. So they understand how it works, but that's not Jack's, background. So how did it work having someone who's, I mean, I was just thinking about like, I guess the other thing like that started the '90s was Dilbert cartoons, right? Like the Dilbert cartoons were all about the engineers being super annoyed about bosses who had all kinds of visions. You know, of course they hated their boss, but like still that thing of like the boss who had all sorts of grandiose ideas and then let the poor engineers down in the cubicles trying to make it work, kind of suffering. So, why is that not how it felt? I'm sure sometimes if, you know, for everyone, nothing's ever perfect. So it's not like it may have never felt that way, but why wasn't that the main theme of, Alibaba? How did his, despite of, or because of his lack of technical expertise, you know, make this thing a success?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of suffering, particularly at the beginning, and, you know, I'm sure, throughout the development of the company, you know, up till, you know, even today. But I think that this goes back to what we talked about, those softer sort of elements that maybe we don't quite appreciate in our business school learning is linking it to a purpose. And these engineers sort of will take pride in working through a problem. And if they can solve the problem or provide the solution, then the rewards are that much more, you know, satisfying or inspiring. So I think that, you know, that is a big motivating factor, and that really relies on kind of how your leader is able to sort of engage and communicate with the team members. It's true, Jack didn't have a traditional background that many of the entrepreneurs at that time, you know, did have. You know, many of them were, you know, PhDs, some of them, you know, graduated from overseas, like MIT and whatnot. And these were the people he was up against. And a lot of people said, well, how on earth can an English teacher go head to head with these guys? And I think part of this is Jack's ability to engage, but also connect the right people together so that you can have that effective mix of, you know, engineering and marketing and management and finance. You know, if you look at his team composition, he had experts in each of these areas and some of them with very impressive backgrounds. And you wonder how he was able to convince them to come be part of the team. And I think that's also an important skill and art of leadership that he was able to bring to the table and then allow them to work effectively together.
So why don't we talk concretely, actually, and one of the, I should say, I'm actually teaching a course this semester in the grad program for on the economics of platforms and, you know, kind of competition strategy between them. So You've been talking more about like internally and the vision of like, how did Alibaba become kind of the dominant platform in China? You know, back in the early 2000s, as you said, you know, it was a struggle for everyone. Like for Stanford, I wrote a case study about HNet, which was later bought out by eBay. And, you know, certainly my first instinct or most people would be like, oh, well, now eBay's entered the market and these, you know, Chinese startups with, you know, less tech and less experience, you know, they're surely going to get wiped out. But that didn't happen. So in that instance or in others you wanted to, you're familiar with, what is it about the platform strategy at Alibaba that's led it to become so dominant?
Yeah, I mean, look, this case I think has been discussed, I'm sure, quite a bit. But people have, you know, their various interpretations. But you know, looking at this from my vantage point, I think you could say there was some you know, technical aspects, but then also kind of the bigger picture. And you know, often what people talk about is localization, like how eBay and even PayPal, for that matter. We're trying to make decisions about the China market from, you know, remotely from Silicon Valley. And basically they took the eBay model and kind of transplanted it into China. Despite having, you know, HNet as a partner, a lot of the UI, UX was premised on kind of the eBay designs that they used in the US. And that kind of plays to a much more kind of clean and simple sort of, you know, design, whereas a lot of what the Chinese users at the time were looking for was something much more lively and kind of, in some ways, people would say messy. So there was this difference in terms of stylistically how the product was presented, but also obviously there was the payment aspect, right? Because there was so few credit card users at the time, and people trying to use PayPal as a means to transact was not covering a large enough market that you could grow this business to tap into the larger customer base. And so the creation of Alipay obviously played a big role in facilitating. But I think also there's this concept of connection. And, you know, eBay's business model was really premised on taking commissions off transactions. And, you know, part of the problem is you never really were able to connect as a buyer to the seller and have a conversation. So one of the things that Taobao created was this AliWangWang communication tool that actually allowed the buyers and sellers to have conversations and even bargain with one another. That created much more of a human interaction. The payment, was done through Alipay, but there was no commission taken. So there was no deterrent to go off platform to actually do this. And as you know, everyone knows, Taobao didn't charge fees for many years. And they eventually, once they got the critical mass, then they were able to monetize through advertising. But it was the human kind of element that I think was very important in maintaining kind of the engagement of the customers with the buyers, so that the merchants, so that they could have a more authentic kind of human experience. And I think finally, the way that the team framed the market, addressable market, everyone talks about how eBay had, like, you know, some say 70%. I've read 95% market share when Taobao was trying to start out. But the Taobao leaders at the time, they didn't look at the addressable market just as those who were only online doing purchasing already through the internet on e-commerce. That was about 3 million users at the time. And you could say that HNet had dominant market share. But if you think about the total netizens number of people online in China around that time, it was more like 90 million. So that could be one addressable market. And then there was the total consumer base, which was like 700 million. And Taobao used the approach, like, our market is not the 3 million, it's not the 90 million, it's the 700 million that we want to engage. So they actually used more traditional means to market to these potential Taobao users, and did a lot of offline engagement in terms of training and these kinds of sessions to kind of educate the population. And I think that was also part of the framing that allowed them to kind of grow the market in a way that, you know, went beyond what most would expect.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. So not trying to just dominate a market that's predefined, but really, which, you know, I guess I would think like any good startup should be doing is like, how are we going to create a new market, right? Something that people didn't even know that they needed or that was possible, and let's make that happen. It's interesting here also, because it's actually the same thing that I've heard from like Amazon, but they present it for a different reason. You know, that they're, you know, people are making antitrust, raising antitrust issues with them and saying, you know, you dominate the online the e-commerce market. And they're saying, well, but, you know, people can buy stuff lots and lots of places. And if you consider all the things people buy or all the other ways people could buy stuff that we sell, we only still have, you know, a tiny fraction of that. So don't worry. So a lot of it, depends what agenda. I mean, they it's the same perspective as Taobao, but more in a defensive sense.
Yes.
But it all depends on what agenda you want to have when you frame these things.
Yes, exactly.
How about, just to jump into something that sounds fun. So tell me about wild dogs, bulls, and rabbits.
Great. You're talking about the Alibaba Zoo? No. a bunch of animals. We used this back in the day too. There is an Alibaba Zoo, by the way, and it's essentially the collection of characters that represent each of the businesses. You know, like there's a cow for B2B, and there's a cat for Tmall, and there's bird for our messaging platform. But this is this was an earlier sort of, framework that Savio Kwan, our Alibaba's first COO, came up with in terms of how to evaluate and develop your people. And so this concept of wild dogs, bulls, and rabbits, think about a framework where you have a y-axis, which is your business performance, and your x-axis, which is your values. And what you try and do is assess, you know, how somebody is performing relative to their business performance, but also their adherence or belief in living the company values. Now, this might sound a bit strange because, like, where do values come into play, like evaluating people's values in a company? And this isn't like a moral judgment on the people, but it's really like, you know, how much do they believe in exemplify the things that are important to a company in terms of how, you know, we make decisions and kind of how we prioritize, things in our day-to-day actions. And so the way it works is a dog is someone who is neither a good performer in business nor a good example of living the company values. And that's somebody that probably isn't doing well at the company and is in serious need of help or should probably, you know, be let go. You have someone who on the other spectrum, the stars or and they and we also referred to them as bulls because there's a kind of a, this is newbie, like a bull ring, we call it. So if they're both strong in performance and in their values, they're in the upper right quadrant. So those are the opposite of dogs. And then you've got these individuals who might not be good business performers, but are exemplary in their values. And we call them the rabbits. They're on the lower right quadrant. And those are people who can actually be nurtured and develop because they have the good values and they just need to up their skill level and performance. And so you try and really focus on them in terms of guiding them to perform better in on the business side. And then you have something called the wild dogs. They're really good performers, but they don't exemplify the values. Sometimes they might even be the opposite of the values that you want to promote. And those are the most dangerous ones because they look really good in terms of you know, their contributions to the company, but they can also, undermine the kind of company culture that you're trying to build because, you know, they're doing things, you know, they're cutting corners or maybe they're not, reflecting the things that are important in the company values, but they're still getting the results. And that can become a cancer because people start to emulate the better performers and think that that's okay. And that's where you have to be very cognizant of what to do with these types of employees. And this was something that I think helped shape the company early on so you could create the right culture at a startup that, you know, very much depended on these aspects.
That seems tough, though, if you have someone who is like a top salesperson or, you know, one of your best coders and they're just, you know, doing a great job on the thing that they're supposed to do. But I don't know, how would you ease them out, you know, in that kind of context?
Well, so that's why, you know, early on in the company, we would do these quarterly evaluations and talk about, you know, how each of the staff is doing. And we would talk about, you know, the values and whether or not, you know, we sort of believe that they were being reflected in it. We call it the process, like, you know, how do you make decisions? And it's a pretty in-depth kind of personal conversation. But it's something that is, at that time, it was, you know, 50% of the evaluation. And you know, I think that it was a hard decision. And that's why this framework was so important, I think, in shaping kind of the company in the direction, because those conversations were difficult to have, but very critical. And, you know, there are examples where in the history of the company, I think there was this blacklist scandal in 2010, where you had these salespeople who were signing up a large number of accounts out of this Fujian area, Putian. And there was a lot of pressure on the company to perform at that time. And a lot of these accounts were actually fraudulent. And, you know, these salespeople were in kind of, you know, collaboration with these fraudsters, but they wanted to sign up the accounts for their performance measures. And the actual sales amount was immaterial. It was less than, I think, like 1% of the total revenue or 5% of the total revenue. Yet it was so important symbolically that, you know, this not only led to decision of dismissal of those sales managers who allowed this to happen, but also the CEO and COO of the Alibaba.com entity because of the lack of, you know, management and, you know, of this very important issue. If it had gotten any worse, then it could have really destroyed the company. I think the point that Jack and everyone was trying to make is that this is a very, very important issue that we cannot ignore. And that, I think, is an example of how big a decision was made around an issue like this.
Now, that's a nice example, actually. I'm going to plug a friend's book. A very friend, Ben Ho, who teaches at Vassar and sometimes Columbia, wrote a book last year called Trust. And it's he's an economist, and it's all about how trust, you know, sounds like a kind of airy-fairy concept, but when you think about like how, what businesses are for and how people do business, you know, a lot of it really does come down to that, right? If Alibaba as a platform, you know, designed to connect real people to, you know, real people selling stuff to customers and wanting people to have confidence that their transaction is going to work, you know, if that falls apart, or, you know, or if investors feel like, oh, you know, they're just creating kind of vapor and it's not real, you know, they're not a real platform, they're just trying to make it look like more than it is, then that, yeah, that can totally collapse the whole endeavor. So
absolutely,
that's crucial kind of to maintain.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think your friend, his book is touching on a very important point, because without trust in any marketplace, you can't have, you know, a vibrant kind of, you know, community that's willing to transact with one another. And I think that was also the driving force in this decision. Trust, our latest or Alibaba's latest value system, I should point out, like I keep saying our, but I no longer work for the company, but trust makes it simple is the new sort of value of the six values they have in their new iteration, because it is so critical as a foundation of any marketplace. And without that, things become very complicated.
That's a nice slogan. I like that one a lot. I think that's captures a lot of things about, about what makes a platform. Well, about the world, sure. I mean, actually, yeah. I mean, you know, also, yeah, just so narrowly about a platform business, but also like, yeah, just about everything is like, how do we get trust? How do we make that work? And yeah. Well, so let's, as the last couple topics, I do want to hear more about, you know, you mentioned that, I mentioned like, you know, this is part of China's broader development, but like, let's talk more concretely. Like, how do you see Alibaba as having contributed to, not just kind of the prosperity of, you know, a few people, but to the ordinary person, or even poorer people in China? And then how, I want you to talk about your efforts to kind of, roll that out, through the Alibaba Global Initiative.
Sure. Well, I mean, for me, this is a big reason why I stayed at the company for the amount of time I did, and why, as you mentioned, I went back to the company after leaving for business school. And then, you know, I think that the initial, thrust of the company when it started to help small businesses was an attractive one to me, because who doesn't want to help those who are being underserved, but also represent an important part of the society. So small businesses was very much a focus of the platform in terms of empowerment. But what I think people started to realize, you know, with the advent of Taobao and then Alipay and many of the other businesses, it really started to seep into the everyday society in China with the consumers and the entrepreneurs in particular. And it was leading to job creation in ways that people didn't expect, particularly amongst the younger generation, where you had an increase, you know, of college graduates that were coming to the market. And, you know, initially the plum job was a state-owned enterprise or working in the government, and then it became multinationals, and then it started to become, you know, being an entrepreneur. I wouldn't say, I think multinationals were still very much the attractive job for many of the top graduates back in the early 2000s, but for those who couldn't get jobs at those fancy firms, they still needed to find something to do, and many of them started to move towards e-commerce. And so youth employment, I think, was another aspect of this. But, you know, probably most profoundly in terms of what I saw was how it affected the rural areas. And in 2012, I decided to kind of take some time off and do a walkabout, so to speak, in the rural parts of China. Jack said, go to the poorest areas in the country and stay there. And if you're comfortable, then move and go somewhere else where you'll be even less comfortable. And if you're not comfortable at that area, then stay longer and ask yourself why. And I thought that was a very strange kind of a suggestion. But when I did that, it actually helped me see things in a way that I was probably, it was an awakening in terms of, you know, where problems exist in society and what is it that is important to me and what I want to, you know, how do I respond to that? And what I saw was the hollowed villages that everybody talked about, where a lot of the young working people leave the villages and they leave their children who are infants behind and the grandparents. And it was probably one of the most depressing things to go through a village and see really old people and holding infants. And I remember sitting in a town square and there was some performance there in Guizhou province, one of the poorest areas in China. And it was just like, you know, this kind of felt like a ghost town, and you had old people performing with in front of these little kids who were being held by grandparents. And I went back to Hangzhou after that to meet some of the staff, just because I was taking the time off. I wanted to share with them what I had seen. And one of my colleagues said, "Hey, Brian, well, if you're concerned about the rural development areas, you should really look at these Taobao villages." And the Taobao villages was a phenomenon that kind of happened organically, where people will set up e-commerce businesses in the villages, not only to procure and buy products, which were sorely in need because a lot of the villages didn't have access to, you know, quality products. You'd be surprised, some of the most number of fake products sold in China is actually to the rural communities because they don't know the difference. So that was solving one problem. But the other problem was actually creating jobs. And these communities that were creating these Taobao villages were either figuring out how to sell their local produce to the urban markets, or they were actually creating whole new industries in their village areas and becoming very, very prosperous. So I've got, you know, there's plenty of stats to share on this, but some of the villages I visited, they were able to raise their per capita income by five times within like 5-6 years, thanks to e-commerce. And they were not only stopping the outflow of populations from leaving the villages, they're actually able to attract more people to the villages to be part of that phenomenon. So to me, that was very meaningful and impactful. And I saw how Alibaba is really kind of transforming the society, both urban and rural, through its e-commerce creations.
So how did that then, I think you set up, or at least you were leading the Alibaba Global Initiative, and sort of taking these ideas on the road. Tell us about that.
Well, so the Alibaba Global Initiatives was a program that Jack asked us to set up to share the learnings from the last 20 years. So, you know, over those 20 years, Alibaba created an e-commerce ecosystem, a payment and finance ecosystem. It created a logistics network and a cloud computing business. And how all four of those fit together, you know, was really led to this phenomenon that I created, that I mentioned in terms of the social impact. So I think one of the things that Jack was really excited about is you know, engaging entrepreneurs from all over the world and kind of sharing with them our experience at Alibaba so that they could take whatever is applicable and apply it to their markets. And so we would invite entrepreneurs from Southeast Asia, from Africa, Latin America, to come to Hangzhou and kind of see the things that we were doing, but also how it was affecting society. And then they would go back to their countries. These were all, you know, tech entrepreneurs. And in many cases, they would apply these principles. It could be something as simple as kind of the technology that they observed or the products, you know, like in terms of e-commerce or you know, the payment systems that they saw or the logistics. Or it could be something even more fundamental in terms of how they looked at their business and how they re-geared it around a stronger mission and vision and how they integrated that into the larger ethos of the organization. And, you know, as a result of that, there's been some really interesting stories that have come from the learnings that they took from those trainings. You know, whether it's in Malaysia, this one entrepreneur created this insurance tech business that initially he was just, you know, he's an ex-banker and he thought it would be worthwhile to try and sell insurance online. But after seeing, the impact of kind of Ali's ecosystem in China, he said, I'm going to focus on what they call the B40, the bottom 40 population, and figure out a way to create and sell affordable insurance for people who are in the informal economy. And now he's the largest, insurance tech company in, his region, providing it to all the delivery drivers like Foodpanda and whatnot, and providing insurance to e-commerce platforms like Shopee. And that's been breakthrough because it's allowed people who are vulnerable in society previously to have protection. And other examples like in Rwanda, and in Kenya, Nigeria, that you know, relate to payment, fintech models, and logistics. So to me, that was just like the capstone to all the work that we had done at the company in the prior 20 years, is how to share that and enable entrepreneurs the opportunity to see what is possible and then try and support them in the ways that we could.
That's great. Yeah. So it's a wonderful way to take, you know, like you said, the learning and experience of one company in one country, and hopefully bring it to the rest of the world. That's always been the question for development people, is like, okay, China's had this great development success story, but what can be exported? And it's, and even I think, you know, the Chinese experts, it's like, well, don't just try to do exactly what we did, but yeah, like there's definitely, it's a careful process of like figuring out like what here is useful and what can be localized to your own context. But there's definitely is a lot to be shared. And I think, nice to see that kind of sharing of information, insight across, not just flowing from, the US with its one successful model to the rest of the world, but sort of what we call South-South cooperation and as well.
That's right.
So last thing I wanted to ask you is where do you see, how do you see the tech sector now in China? You know, a ton has happened even in the past couple of years since you've been working on this book. You know, Xi Jinping has really consolidated power a lot and imposed a lot more regulation on the tech sector. There's been the COVID pandemic, obviously, and China's commitment to this dynamic zero COVID strategy. And then on top of that, these increasing tensions with the US and China that have limited a lot of forms of interchange across all domains, but especially in the area of high tech. So where do you see things going?
Yeah, you know, Peter, since the time I started writing the book up till now, there have been seismic shifts in the world, and even I am trying to kind of figure out how all this is going to play out. But the way I look at what's happening in China today is certainly very tough for the tech sector. It's been tough for many sectors due to regulatory changes and policy changes. I think what we're seeing in the China tech space is a maturation of certain areas where, previously in the last 20 years, it's been a late touch approach where the government provides the infrastructure and the enabling environment for the digital economy to grow and prosper. And they didn't get too involved, and that's what allowed the innovation to happen. But now that certain areas have matured, like say fintech and related areas, it requires regulation in order to protect consumers and also ensure that, some of these concerns about data privacy and antitrust are kind of managed effectively. Now, this isn't a unique sort of problem or challenge or concern. I think governments all over the world, whether it be Europe or US, have the same concerns about big tech. But I think it's really the methods that governments use to manage this that differ. And in some ways, what China has experienced is a very sort of blunt approach that has had, an impact in terms of things like investor confidence or whatnot. But I do think, it's time will tell, in terms of how this plays out. I think there's also an upgrade on the government's desire is to upgrade the kind of quality of China's industrial capacity. I think that what they're trying to do is shift, obviously, the flow of capital to the areas that are of strategic importance to the country. That's things like, you know, green tech, alternative energy, semiconductors, life sciences. I think that those areas will continue to thrive moving forward. And there will be plenty of business opportunities for investors and entrepreneurs. I think that the ones like e-commerce and payments, they're so large that they will absolutely continue. They're an integral part of the ecosystem. But, you know, it's really a matter of where the growth opportunities are in those sectors. People probably need to be more selective. You know, the industrialization of the supply chain is definitely something that will continue. And that relates to e-commerce because it ties into the demand data that is generated from the e-commerce retail side. And then, you know, a company needs to figure out how to gear itself to produce in a more efficient way. So if you're asking me, like, you know, my thoughts, I think it's really, you have to put it in the context of the country and what they're trying to achieve. And hopefully the entrepreneurs will be able to see this and adapt and, you know, find the opportunities for them to contribute to the growth in the areas that are now priorities.
Yeah, it's definitely a changing environment. Not the Wild West of the 90s and 2000s, it seems like. But, you know, as you said, you know, there's a reason, you know, the Wild West in the U.S. is also not the Wild West anymore. We're not like abandoning ships in the San Francisco Harbor to go run and get gold or whatever, right?
Yeah, exactly. We've seen it on both sides, yeah, Peter. You know, people like us are, I would say, beneficiaries of being able to kind of go between the East and the West. And I guess what I would hope is that we don't lose sight of that. I think there's so much in the way of political tension today, but you know, at the foundation of all this was kind of, you know, both the business and the cultural kind of connections. And I would hope that, you know, we can also recognize how that connection between, say, U.S. and China or Silicon Valley and in you know, the tech communities in China actually help benefit both sides. But, you know, there is concern now around, you know, these geopolitical issues. And so how do you sort of manage that, but at the same time allow the foundation to continue to, you know, to develop and grow?
Yeah, that's the challenge. All right. So I know you're still based in Shanghai, but you're in the U.S. now and doing you know, focusing on your book for the time being. What are you going to be involved in next?
Well, do you know yet? Sorry,
I was just going to ask you, yeah, what's okay. Next for you after the book winds down?
Yeah, you know, so for me, Peter, what's important to me is still this kind of East-West relationship and trying to figure out, as any entrepreneur would, I guess, you know, how to play within and adapt to the, you know, the new landscape. I think there are areas of collaboration, as I was just mentioning, that still remain very important for the two countries. And we have bigger issues that we cannot solve individually, like, you know, climate change and these issues that are existential, you know, public health. So I'm going to do what I can in my capacity to figure out how to continue to bridge those, you know, communication and engagement. I'm focusing right now on a passion project, which is really trying to use, you know, storytelling in media to bridge cultural understanding between China and the West, particularly amongst the youth. So I have a platform called Radii, radii.co. It's a media platform that really tells stories about, you know, youth culture from the, you know, from the greater China region, sort of the Chinese diaspora. And it's things around music, art, design, film, even some tech and, you know, sustainability. These are topics that I think are very important to, you know, the younger generation and also us. But I think it's the younger generations that are really continue to thrive and pursue creative ideas that I think represent the consciousness of you know, that younger sort of generation. And so I hope that people can see through these storytelling that, you know, we have a lot more in common than different, and that China is not a monolith. And the Chinese culture is very diverse. And, you know, that's something I'm focusing my time on. The second would be just continuing to back, you know, really high potential entrepreneurs who are doing meaningful ventures, and continue to share with them some of the lessons that we learned from the Alibaba experience.
Great. Well, yeah, I follow Radii on Twitter, and it's good for me also to like just get a sense of, you know, just things that are happening in people's lives, like you said, in pop culture and yeah. And other you know, just kind of regular stuff,
yeah.
As well as all the geopolitics and yes. the investment and the financial details, right? You know, it's I think again, you know, that's where you and I started, is just like going to China in our 20s and like meeting a bunch of people and saying, gee, you know, they're different, you know, they're not like people back home, but they're people and they're great. And,
yeah.
you know, there's so much benefit in these two countries working together and you know, our people's getting to know each other better.
Absolutely.
Let me also, I guess, pitch on that same theme. I'm part of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations Public Intellectuals Program, and 2 years ago, you actually joined me for this in a remote version. But they have on November 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern, they're going to have a telecast where former Ambassador John Huntsman will
Great.
Be talking about the U.S.-China relations. And there's also local partners in various communities. So for instance, at USF, we'll have a little event where we'll watch the telecast, and then I have some other experts coming to join me to talk about what's happening. And anyone listening to this, sort of wherever you are, there's probably a university or other place where you can join in this and not just listen to the, you know, the famous guy talk, but also have a conversation with other people in your community about, you know, what's going on with China, you know, how should we deal with these many challenges we face in the relationship, and how is that affecting your community?
Sounds like a great session.
All right. So yeah. I think we'll, yeah. And so, and Brian was kind enough to join us during our pandemic version of this a couple of years ago, which all remote, but I think it'll be even better this year to actually, you know, again, just have members of the community get together and, you know, have active discussions on this topic.
Yeah. Excellent.
So with that, let's, I'm going to say thanks, and this has been great, and wish you all the best with the book. I should say the title of the book again. It's The Tao of Alibaba, Inside the Chinese Digital Giant That is Changing the World by Brian A. Wong, and everyone should go out and get themselves a copy.
Thanks so much.